Well, we are going to be looking at some point at Rome or Revelation 17. If you want to have your finger there. At some time today. By the way, you know, I mentioned last week the Old Testament reading that kind of had parts of it just pulled out. You know, we were missing like two verses 5 through 6, and then I can't remember. But I found another reading that's coming up in year C, so it'll be a couple of years from now, where you get another instance of a reading that's, let me see, I'll read it. You can hear where it goes. Yeah. It's Revelation 22, 12 through 14, 16 through 17, 20 through 21. And look what gets left out in this one. Actually, let's look at this. It has some relevance for today. Revelation 22, starting with 12. This is the big conclusion to the book. And Jesus is speaking, "See, I'm coming very soon. My reward is with me to repay according to everyone's work. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed are those who wash their robes so that they will have the right to the tree of life and may enter the city gates, or enter the city by the gates." And this has been left out. "Outside are the dogs and sorcerers and fornicators and murderers and idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood." So you don't get that part. And then it continues. "It is I, Jesus, who sent my angel to you with this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the descendant of David, the bright morning star. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And let everyone who hears say, come. And let everyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who wishes to take the water of life as a gift." And then you don't get this part. "I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to that person the plagues described in this book. And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away that person's share in the tree of life and in the holy city which are described in this book." Now, I got to tell you, I think that's fairly scary to take words out that say, don't take these words out.
Who took the words out?
Those who came up with the Revised Common Lectionary.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me. I missed that part.
Now, churches are allowed, at least according to the rules of the Revised Common Lectionary, to add, to make passages longer or whatever, and I would suggest that they put that stuff back in. If not, because it does a disservice. You know, people are reading this, and they hear it in church, and they say, oh, that's all lovely and everything, and then they go and they look in their Bibles, and there's another side of the story that they're not being told. And I don't see how that's helpful. Yes, those are troubling words. But notice that even after, in 15, after it says, you know, outside are the dogs and sorcerers and fornicators and murderers and idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood, after that in 17, you get this calling to everybody. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And let everyone who hears say, come. Let everyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who wishes to take the water of life as a gift come. I mean, that kind of takes care of that other part, does it not? I mean, those who are outside are the ones who have refused to come. It's not that they got overlooked. It's that they have continually refused, which, as you read Revelation, you wonder who could ever continually refuse that long, you know?
Why are dogs in that group? I just
wonder. I mean, dogs are unclean, scavenging animals. They're not domestic pets.
Oh.
So to live out among the dogs...
So you mean Queen Victoria's little lapdog is not there?
That's not what's being connoted here.
All right.
Wrong dog.
So when the Syrophoenician woman comes to Jesus and says, heal my daughter, and he says it's not right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. And she says, yes, Lord, but even the dogs under the table eat the scraps. And what she's done is she has transferred this, there's this one idea of a dog is a scavenging dog, but she has replaced that image with a pet image. She's retained the language of dog, but said, but the Gentiles aren't thieves, and we are those, you know.
So in those cultures, so I'm thinking like modern dogness started sometime in 1850, you know, when they brought back the weird little dogs from China, and the Europeans went back over, and the rest of it, so it's history. But, you know, that in that ancient culture, there were really even then two ideas of dogs.
Yes.
There's horrible scavenging animals, and then there was cultures that said, oh, you know, they could be nice to have around.
Yeah,
right?
Because I think you did have in Roman culture, Greek culture of the time, you did have the elite who had started to have dogs as pets.
Okay.
But I think in Israel, I don't think dogs were, I think they were just scavengers.
Yeah, they weren't considered.
So, year C, the last Sunday of Easter, so it's a couple of years, keep that in mind, request that your church read the whole thing.
The cats?
Well, in Egypt, they worshiped them. So, okay.
As they should.
Now, I wanted to pick up with one thought last week. Keith had...
Ted, before you go on that...
Yes.
Excuse me, but this thing with the wedding feast today, and the guy didn't show up with the garment, and he had thrown, you know, I feel like I'm listening to some bizarre, you know, like the Russians decide to put on an SNL skit, and I can't understand what they're talking about. But what, why are you getting thrown out for having the, whatever that was that God was supposed to be wearing?
Because many are called and few are chosen. Okay. Let me say briefly. This is the parable of a king who. By the way, parables in Matthew are violent. And people have studied this sort of thing. Why are Matthew's parables violent and Luke's aren't? You know, I mean, in Matthew, people are being thrown out with wailing and gnashing of teeth. What happened in this parable? What is it? Matthew, what?
Did he do the vineyard thing? Where
this follows the vineyard.
Oh, this is right after the vineyard.
This is right after the vineyard, which I think is important. Matthew 22, parable of the wedding banquet. Luke has a parable almost identical to this, except it's a man, it's not a king, but a man who is throwing a wedding feast for his son, and he goes, he says, bring in everybody that I've invited, the wedding feast is ready, and one guy says, well, I just bought some oxen I need to go try out. And another guy says, well, I just bought a field, I need to go look at it. Another guy says, well, I've gotten married, I can't come. And you're supposed to go nudge, nudge, wink, wink. That's part of the humor of that one. Because he doesn't give a reason. He just says, I've just gotten married, can't come. Now, one of the things to realize, particularly in an honor-shame society, when you've invited people, you know, the invitations have gone out, they've known about the wedding, it might take a few days to prepare for it, so when you've prepared for it, then you go and call, you know, and it could take them days to get there and all this, because it's a week-long celebration sort of deal. But in an honor-shame culture, if somebody has invited you, and if you've invited somebody, they are within your circle, and they refuse to come, they have dishonored you. I mean, this isn't just, oh, I'm sorry. This is, you don't do this. All right? And so what does, in Luke's parable, the man, the father says, all right, well then forget them. Go out into the streets and bring people in. So they go out into the streets and they bring people in. And he says, my wedding hall is not full. Go out into the hedgerows, into the alleys, into the dark places, and bring in the lame, the blind, you know, all of those. Because I tell you what, those who are invited, none of them are going to taste anything in my feast. Now, This is like Jesus' table fellowship, is it not? He's been dishonored by the leadership of Israel. And what he does is he eats with tax collectors and sinners. Now, the thing that's important is that this parable in Matthew is completely different. I mean, it follows the same pattern, but it's completely different because we're not just dealing with a man who has a son. We're dealing with a king who has a son and who is giving a wedding banquet. So the people that he has invited are probably people that are within his political connections, maybe other kings or, you know, other his subjects, all of this sort of thing. And so when they say, no, we're not coming, which is a significant dishonor, what does he do? Well, he gets his army out and he kills them all, you know. Now, see, realize, this is a story. I mean, people who are listening to this would know that this is a bit extreme. I mean, they're not looking and thinking, oh, this is just normal. I mean, the first hearers would have thought, this is, you know, I mean, this is a story. You can do things in stories, in parables that you don't do in other sorts of things. But then the odd thing is, particularly if you have Luke's parable in mind where everybody is invited, the lame and all of this sort of thing, you get to the end and the king comes in, but when the king came in to see the guest, he noticed a man there who was not wearing a wedding robe. And he said to them, friend, how did you get in here without a wedding robe? And he was speechless, as is the reader. Then the king said to the attendants, bind him hand and foot, throw him out in the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen. Exactly. Is anybody familiar with Flannery O'Connor? Flannery O'Connor, a southern writer, I don't know, she wrote in the 50s or 60s. If you read Flannery O'Connor's stuff, it is some of the most horrendous sorts of things, I mean, that happen to people. And people debated about whether she's just writing to shock people, but one of the things that she's doing in her writing, I mean, she has children who are molested, things like this, but she's kind of considered, I mean, this is literature as opposed to pop sort of stuff. I mean, people study this, and one of the questions is, what is she doing? Well, she's not presenting life as it is, as we see it, but kind of the hiddenness of life in stark images. And she said to wake people up, not to shock them in terms of entertainment value, but to wake them up to the spiritual dimension of life where you have this starkness between evil and good and that sort of thing. Jesus sometimes uses these stark images in order to get us to think about things. In summary, what I think this parable is about is that God sends his son. This is just like the parable of the tenant. It's right before this. God sends his son, and the people of Israel, particularly the leaders, reject him. They dishonor God by, in a sense, refusing to come to the banquet, the wedding feast of his son. So what does he do? He opens the doors up to everybody. All right? But it's not just that everybody gets in automatically. There is still a demand for righteousness. There is still, you know, it's not just that all of a sudden all tax collectors and sinners are automatically in. Only those who come to the wedding feast and participate and sit down and are involved in that. And so he's saying that there is still, I mean, you have in Matthew, you have parables where somebody goes out and starts throwing a net into the sea and catching in all kinds of fish. And then they get the good fish in and they throw the bad fish back out. So he's saying that there's this demand for discipleship. And it's not just automatic. All are called. You know, but few are chosen because few have chosen to participate. Now, one of the arguments is that, and I don't know if this goes beyond the parable, but one of the arguments is that some have suggested is that the wedding robe would have been provided. And the fact that this man doesn't have one on means that he is rejected in some sense. I'm not sure if that's, you know, because the man's kind of speechless. I don't know. But I... But I think the main thing is that, broadly speaking, many in Israel rejected the Son, so the doors were open to all of Israel, and yet not all followed. Many are called, few are chosen.
What I'm getting from you is not everybody sitting out there the first time hearing this and saying, oh my gosh, I mean, yeah, he didn't have a wedding. Oh, well, of course, you know. It wasn't necessarily like that. You know, like everybody knows kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, can't we do that? I think it's probably not like that.
I don't think so. I think his hearers probably would have said, oh, you know. I mean, Jesus stood up at one point in his sermons and said, you know, it's not enough to hear my words. The wise man is the one who hears my words and does them. It's the sheep and the goats. Lord, when did we see you hungry and naked and all of this? I mean, this is a constant theme in Matthew, that God is coming to transform the world, and he is not going to transform you against your will. Now, all you need is the faith as small as a mustard seed. I mean, he's not asking much, but he is asking for your participation. And there's Jesus presenting a parable without any gray areas. And it's a shocking parable. And I think the original hearers would have been shocked. By whatever, you know. So, that's my 2 cents on that.
Wouldn't the wedding garment say they had their own type of thing, and not wearing it would be an offense
mm-hmm.
for that
mm-hmm.
because of not showing honor
yeah.
to what's going on?
Yeah, and I think probably honor is behind this whole thing.
Not showing respect.
I mean, it's like, you know, you go out and invite everybody, you know, and they come in and, you know, oh, a buffet, you know, and, you know, whatever they're doing. I didn't think I was going to get invited to that, you know, and just, I don't know. Yeah. So that's my take. But one of the things, and I think this is tricky, how do you know when you're supposed to, as a reader who is not a first century reader in the Roman world, how are you supposed to know when you're to be shocked and not shocked? How is it when you just, it's, oh, I didn't understand that custom, and when you're supposed to be like, well, this is odd, you know. And that's just, you know, that's part of what my job is, I think. I mean, the Bible wasn't written for 21st century Americans. It just wasn't. And so it's part of the church to know, and part of the ministry of the church to have people to look into this sort of thing so that the church as a whole can then get the impact, the same rhetorical impact. And you've got it. I mean, see, that's the thing, is you've got exactly what this parable was expecting you to do, to wonder, to be speechless just like the man. Last week when we were talking about the contents of the scroll, which were that the Lamb is worthy to open, that the mystery that has been hidden and has now been revealed is that God is going to call all the nations, and the nations are going to come to know God. And the mystery is that the way in which the nations will come to know who God is that the followers of the Lamb will, how would we say it, will witness to the truth of God and to the Lamb, will testify to the truth even to the point of death. And that, so you have an army of martyrs who are standing up and proclaiming the gospel, proclaiming God's vision for creation, and they're being killed for it. And the irony of this is that their deaths will be the means by which the nations come to know God. You can think of it in the 60s when you had, you know, one of the things that Martin Luther King Jr. understood was that if about nonviolent direct action. He understood that it wasn't the white person that was the enemy, it was racism that was the enemy. And both blacks and whites had to be rescued from this. And unfortunately, the oppressors hardly ever change their ways. And it's often up to the victims of oppression to stand up and to exert their humanity in such a way that they can rescue both. And so the thought is if a white person comes up and decides to hit a black person unprovoked, and the black person hits him back, the white person feels justified. You know, they're wrong, but they feel justified. I mean, that's the actual feeling that they feel. But if they go up and strike the black person, and the black person neither strikes back nor does run away, but stands back up and turns the other cheek, as it were, exerts their humanity and says, "You cannot treat me in this way. I will not become a dog by cowering, nor will I become a dog by striking, biting back." All of a sudden, the oppressor is confronted with the humanity of this person. They can't treat them as dogs because they're not acting like them in their own minds. And so you have this potential for transformation of the relationship and also the salvation of the oppressor. In the same way as the early Christians go out and proclaim to the world, "Caesar is not Lord, Jesus, this crucified man, is Lord." That caused a lot of violence to be poured out upon Christians, and they did not take up arms and fight back. They did not defend themselves, and so you have a whole, you know, generation of martyrs. Revelation says that while that looks like a defeat, it's actually going to be the salvation of the world. When the Lamb's army stands up and fights not with a sword in their hand but the sword of their mouth, testifies to the truth, they can be killed for it. But, ironically, this is how God is going to transform the world. Now, the question that came up last week was, how does the Holocaust fit into this sort of thing? And there are clearly a lot of people who have thought much more about this. But one of my hesitations, for me it's an open question. I don't know how the Holocaust fits into this. My hesitation with just automatically saying, well, this is what God, you know, this God planned or designed this for his purposes, is that not all suffering is redemptive. I think God can redeem all suffering, can redeem violence. But not all violent self-sacrifice is redemptive in the sense that I don't see how child abuse contributes to God's purposes in the world. You know, and one of the things is that there have been, throughout history, people who've read the Bible and said, well, Jesus' sacrifice is what saved the world, so you who are suffering, just keep suffering. We'll keep oppressing you. You know? I mean, this idea of righteous suffering has been used by the oppressor to keep people in their place. And what I want to say is that I just want to make the point that not all violence that we endure or that is inflicted upon people is redemptive. Any thoughts about that before we move on? I guess another way to say it, suffering in and of itself is not a virtue. And in Revelation, it's not just an army called to suffer, it's an army called to stand up for the truth, even to the point that you may suffer for it. And in that sense, God says, I will redeem that. You know, I will vindicate that.
The only way that she can make sense of why she has to suffer is that through her suffering she will have compassion for people who also
go there, and she seemed to be a counselor to give assistance to people so they don't have to go to the dark places that she went without anyone assisting her.
Mm-hmm.
And just her family trying to tell her, you know, and you don't see your parents. So,
mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm mumbling on about is that in our society, in our Christian culture, where we do understand that some suffering is redemptive,
mm-hmm.
that can help someone to make sense of, you know, an ongoing disease and give them something to hang on to that is hopeful. And yet, it's a two-edged sword because
mm-hmm.
she also battles with, why did this happen to me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why did... And she just goes back and forth. And there's a lot less of that why did and a lot more of hanging on to hopefulness. It's very difficult.
It is difficult, and I think that's kind of the distinction in the sense that you could, there are two ways to look at that and say, well, God has caused her to suffer in order that she could minister to others. And I think, I don't think that's the way it works. But God can redeem and transform that suffering and use it for God's purposes. And this is the difference. I mean, God can create out of nothing. God can create life out of chaos. But that doesn't mean the chaos has its origin in God. Okay?
Yeah.
And because at times God can so transform evil and bring good out of it, you look at it and say, well, it had to be planned. I mean, I'm just saying that this is one of the ways of looking at it. There's a friend of mine who... He said he and his wife had gotten in a really bad argument. He got in a car and was driving away and, bam, got in an accident, you know. And he said he'd been eating a sandwich and he was continuing to chew the sandwich and then realized, no, that was glass in his mouth. So he stood up and said, you know, God, you know, got his attention with that accident. And I think, you know, And what he was trying to say is that after that, he really took stock of things, you know. And to me, that's God coming in the midst of that.
He's not
causing this.
Yeah.
You know, and I just have other questions, too. The poor guy that had to crash into him to, you know. You know, so that, but for him... He's looking and saying, but this is the way that God got my attention. And therefore, he takes one more step that I don't think is necessary. The fact is, this suffering of that sort that you described with your daughter is part of chaos. It's unexplainable. But God hasn't left the situation. A friend of mine, well, a professor of mine, he talked about how he... and I probably told this story before, but he was, I don't know if he was working as a chaplain at the time, but he went into a hospital where a lady was dying, I think, of cancer. And she had a lot of friends come and visit her, and they prayed for her healing. And he came in and he said, has anybody talked to you about the fact that you're going to die? And she says, no, they won't. They just keep coming in and praying for my healing. And he said, well, God can't heal you. Of course, a lot of theology students at the raising their hand, you know, sort of deal. And she was like, well, then where is God? And he said, this is a Catholic hospital, so above her bed there was a crucifix. And he says, if she'd been in a Protestant place, it would just been a cross, but no Jesus on it. And he said, well, God is right here. He said, God couldn't take his own son down from the cross. And again, theology students are raising their hands, you know, saying, well, yes, he could, he just chose not to. But his point was is that, and if you look in the world, he said she was being tortured because she thought that God could heal her and was choosing not to. And he said, yes, there are healings in the Bible, and people do get healed, but also realize this, everybody who gets healed dies. So even in this life, healing is temporary and it's merely a sign, a sacrament of the age to come when all sickness and disease and death will be taken away. So where is God? Well, God is in our midst. God is where the suffering is. I was thinking this week, I had a pastor friend who had a cross that he'd cut holes in it. And it was part of his theology saying, you know, when God looks at us, he doesn't see us, he sees Jesus. And so God looks through the cross when he sees this. And this is part of a type of theology that says, well, how can we be made righteous when we don't have any righteousness in us? Well, Jesus was righteous, and he can, in a sense, credit that righteousness to us. I've become a bit troubled by that because it basically gives the impression that somehow Jesus has to protect us from God. And that God doesn't really see us. And I'm thinking, well, how can God help us? And it comes from a particular verse where it says God can't look upon sin. And it's taken so literally in the sense that God, you know, I've heard people say this. And at one point thought, that's really cool, you know, that when God looks at, you know, when he looked at Jesus on the cross and when Jesus took the sin upon him, he just couldn't stand it. He turned his head and he puked, you know. And that's why Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? But what image of God is this? Who's so queasy? You know, I mean, and Paul would say stuff, you know, it was while we were sinners that God came to us. And I was thinking this week, the cross with the holes makes sense. But it's not that when God looks through the cross, he sees us. It's that when we look through the cross, we see who God is. So God is the one who is by nature self-emptying, who can suffer more profoundly than any human being can suffer, which is why he can come to those who are suffering and be with them. And yes, there is a mystery why some get well and some don't get well. But God is with both. And God is willing to entertain the questions and the anger of those who don't understand why they are suffering and why this happened. And often it's that why question that just terrorizes people. I mean, God has the power to do this, but he's chosen not to. And I'm not sure that that's quite the way it works. Or, you know, God could have stopped something, but he allowed it. Because by definition, if something happens, God must have allowed it because God's almighty. But again, we think of power in human terms. So you take human power and put it to the nth degree, and that's God. But what does Paul mean when he says, when Paul asked God, you know, he said, I had a thorn in the flesh that I prayed 3 times for God to take away from me, and God wouldn't take away, and God said to me, my power is made perfect in weakness. In weakness. My power is made perfect in weakness. Now, yes, we rejoice when people get healed, you know. But there's a mystery of that, to that. There's both a mystery to healing and a mystery to suffering. But when you look at the cross and look through the cross, when you look at Revelation and say, why is the Lamb worthy? The Lamb is worthy because the Lamb suffered on behalf of others. And the Spirit has been poured out on people who follow the Lamb in order to empower them to suffer on behalf of others, to participate in Jesus' ministry.
Isn't there a difference, too, though, between healing and comfort? I was a bit sick in China, and I wasn't usually healed. I had cells that were bad, and had conversion difficulties, and people would come and pray. But my feeling about God and Jesus from Sunday school was, it was like my grandmother's hands on me when I was conversion sick. Hmm. I felt comfort. I didn't get better in healing. Mm-hmm. But I was comforted. Mm-hmm. And that's always what I felt when I prayed, when I was a way girl. It was kind of like Jesus just reached down and touched me, mm-hmm. and I felt more comforted. And that's a big blessing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get any better in fact,
mm-hmm.
but I was more comforted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not alone. Yes, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And, the tradition that I come out of, evangelical tradition, of which I can still consider myself much a part, doesn't know how, on the whole, to deal with suffering. I hear, well, this person died and she was sick for 10 years, didn't complain once, which suggests to me that she didn't have the community that she could be a part of. If you're not complaining, then you're not sharing your life with somebody. And I think in the
I got a lot of sharing.
Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. We don't know how to mourn in this culture, which probably means we don't know how to rejoice either. Our culture just keep death and sickness as far away as possible. We don't know how to deal with it, which is why we need counselors and other people who are trained, pastors who are trained in the ability to do this, to be with people in their suffering, not to try and fix it. I don't know why some people get better and some people don't. I don't think it's an issue of... maybe faith at times plays a role in that, but I don't think it can be the only factor. And Jesus at times says enough. I mean, the book of Job is essentially a critique of this sort of theology. Why are you suffering, Job? You must have done something wrong. Well, I've done things wrong, but my present suffering does not correspond. And the fact is we live in a world in which other people pay the price for our sins. They experience the consequences. My children experience the consequences of my anger, unfounded anger, and my pettiness. And my grandchildren will pay for it as well. We experience the consequences of other people's sins. And God has constructed the world such that he doesn't step in and stop the cause and effect of all of that. I think he does provide comfort, in the midst of that. But God doesn't protect us from this sort of stuff. At least not fully. And part of what it is to be in this army who follows the Lamb who suffered is to be people who can live with their own suffering and live with the suffering of others and comfort one another, be Christ to one another. And I'm not sure exactly how to do all of that, but you can really see when it's not done. I mean, just go when you start talking to somebody and you're wanting to share something painful in your life, and just think, when they respond to you with their words or with whatever, what parts are comforting and what parts aren't comforting? And you'll start, I think, to get a clue to what you can be to other people. And obviously people are a bit different, but on the whole, giving advice, while it may be good advice, isn't sharing in somebody's suffering. And there may be a time for giving advice. But often people don't really come for advice, even if they ask for it. All right? Because they just want to feel better. And they're wanting to connect with someone else and have somebody bear the burden with them. Read Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. I mean, this is kind of this, where, you learn to listen to people and to respond, not just to their words, but to everything that's going on with them. That is where I think Christ operates. That's part of what I think the church is to do, is to take the suffering of the world and and help the world bear it, and at times transform it, and heal people from it, recognizing that full healing will not take place until the Lamb returns and the New Jerusalem is founded. And then guess what's in the New Jerusalem? There's the throne of the Lamb and God. Flowing from the throne is a river of living water, and on either side of the stream is the tree of life, whose leaves are for the healings of the nations. That's the vision. And we get glimpses of that in this life. Healings are a testimony to that. But they're just glimpses. A few minutes for thoughts. We didn't get to the harlot.
I think we face every day, all of us have, once or many times, special and gifted people in life that are those healers. And they're not doctors, and they're not theologians, or they're not counselors. They're someone that could sit with a terminally ill person and know they're doing some good, knowing that it doesn't change the course of events.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that everybody's experienced that.
Well, blessings.